You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēs te tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Thomas. If I can name coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Laura McClure, filling in for Simon Court. I asked about the budget for 2026 and funding for health, defence and cuts to fees free. And I spoke to Associate Professor at the University of Auckland and Co-Director at the Geothermal Institute, Sadio Zaruk, about nuclear energy and if it has a place in New Zealand's energy ecosystem. Thomas, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to University of Auckland Social Sciences Professor Barry Milne about a new study which has linked deaths of despair with living in deprived areas. And I also talked to Greenpeace freshwater campaigner Will Appleby about the organisation calling for New Zealand to follow Denmark and lower the drinking water nitrate limit.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or ai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e wareware e ahena koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki maronga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more, as always, by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
2 weeks ago saw the government announcing its budget for 2026, which saw major cuts across the public sector alongside new spending announcements for health, defence and numerous other sectors. The health sector particularly has been under significant pressure over recent years, with healthcare workers consistently calling for more support due to overcrowding and underfunding. While the government committed $6 billion to health earlier in its term, the problem has yet to significantly improve. The government has also committed to increasing defence spending, with accusations floating around that New Zealand has been a freeloader dependent on military support from our allies in the US and Australia. The new commitment will see New Zealand's defence funding expected to rise to 2% of GDP by 2028. This budget also saw cuts to the fees-free program, which subsidised tertiary course fees during students' final year of study. The government says that this program was too expensive and did not deliver enough value for money. Lastly, ACT's Laura McClure, alongside three other MPs from multiple political parties, was banned from entering China last week following a visit to Taiwan. For this week's catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Laura McClure about each of these issues, beginning with discussions over her recent ban from entering China. What are your takeaways from this travel ban, and how does it affect New Zealand's or your broader stance towards China?
Yeah, look, it was really surprising, given the fact that members of parliament for many years have been travelling to Taiwan on an annual basis under the One China policy. So it was nothing new, this trip. It was something that happens every year. I'm part of a cross-party friendship group between Taiwan MPs and New Zealand MPs. And look, the trip is really to discuss our cultural ties, and quite a few people know now, but if you don't, Māori have Indigenous ties back to one of the 17 iwi in Taiwan, so it's pretty cool. They even speak pretty much similar language, like Te Reo, and their language is very similar. And they're also our eighth biggest export market, so that economic tie is really important. So talking trade and meeting with businesses, New Zealand businesses and businesses that trade between the two countries is very valuable. So look, I was really surprised, considering this is a long-standing tradition of it occurring. And I was obviously pretty upset that it had been banned, considering neither member of parliament even my colleagues that went in the last couple of years have not been banned. So I was a bit surprised and disappointed, and I believe the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Prime Minister's Office are making that quite clear to the Chinese Embassy in New Zealand.
And next I wanted to talk about the budget. It's a little while ago now, but we didn't get the chance to catch up with the ACT Party last week. First, I want to talk about health. We've seen a big bump in health spending announced in this year's budget. Where is that health spending going exactly?
Yeah, so it is a record funding for health this time around. There's quite a few different areas, but essentially it's investing in more medicines to make sure that we are, you know, a first world country that we claim to be, and make sure that we've got the best medicines available for things like cancers and leukemia, cystic fibrosis, rheumatoid arthritis, all of the autoimmune diseases. So there's a big bump in that. There's also a boost for ambulance services as well, because we know that frontline care is really important. And some more funding towards that frontline, which I think anybody in New Zealand who's been to a hospital in the last couple of years will know, at the coalface, it's pretty tough out there. And even just getting an appointment with a GP can be really a real struggle. So I think it is important that we invest in something that, as taxpayers and as New Zealanders, we expect to, you know, be able to get a good quality service out of our health system.
You mentioned some of the struggles that the healthcare system has been facing. We've seen overcrowding and we've seen underfunding criticised from within the health system since COVID and since that COVID period. We saw also $6 billion of health spending committed in an earlier budget by this government, which didn't solve the problem, right? We still see overcrowding and we still see some underfunding problems as well. How can we be confident that this new spend is going to have an impact?
Because I think it's not just about the spend. It's actually about driving performance and cutting waste in the back as well. So it's not always about money. We could tip and a whole lot of money into something and it doesn't always fix the problem. So it's things like getting the wait lists down when it comes to elective surgery. It's about running them more efficiently. I mean, we have people that say don't show up for their elective surgery, and that can bump the list like quite significantly. You have the operating theatre ready to go and then they can't actually complete the surgery. So there's stuff that they're doing in the around the back that is around actually better communications with people, making the system go much faster on that elective side, which actually frees up the doctors for like more of the frontline emergency as it comes through. So I think it's not just about the money. I think it's about finding the efficiencies as well and the ways in which it can work smarter, not necessarily, you know, throwing more money at a problem and not really having anywhere to go with it.
Next, I want to talk about defence spending. We've seen that in this budget efforts to raise our defence spending in line with increasing its percentage of our relative GDP as a country. Why is this increased defence spending coming about now? Is this something that's very important to the government, developing our military?
Yeah, look, ACT actually campaigned last election on increasing to 2% GDP because we could see the geopolitical situation is getting more and more volatile. Like, we're in the most volatile position as a planet that we've probably been in since pre-World War II. So our relative peace and security living at the bottom of the planet is not necessarily a given, and I think it's really important that New Zealand thinks about how we can secure ourselves, our sovereignty, and also secure all of our shipping routes. One of the most important things, I think, is getting goods in and out of New Zealand, and we need to be able to pull our weight in that retrospect. So I think it's great that we're investing more in defence. We're looking at having more autonomous vehicles, which we know New Zealand companies and defence industry here in New Zealand are like world leaders at. So things like drones, whether it's on the water, whether it's in the sky, will actually help us do not just defence things, but for example, monitoring for illegal fishing out in the Pacific, and be used for natural disasters, which we know we have plenty of as well in our region.
There's been questions raised of New Zealand increasing its defence spending and potentially becoming seen as more of a defence spender, right? Inadvertently putting a more of a target on our back, I guess. How would you respond to those claims? And do you think that's something that New Zealand has to worry about?
No, look, I think it's everybody around the globe is considering how much defence spending they should be investing, given that instability. And our partners, our only ally is Australia, or true ally, should I say, or official, and they've been upping their defence spending. And I think it's only reasonable that New Zealand should try and match that and make sure that we've got some sort of value add. And like I said, it's not just about, preparing for future potential conflicts. It's actually about making sure that our Defence Force can do the job that they need to do here in New Zealand and in the Pacific, which is a huge deal. I don't know if many of the listeners are aware, but we have the largest economic exclusion zone out off the coast of New Zealand. And, you know, part of our role in out there is looking out for illegal fishing, for example, and making sure our Defence Force, our Navy, are able to, and our Air Force, you know, have the equipment and the gear they need to go out and do that sort of work as well, is really important to New Zealanders and definitely the best interests of the Pacific.
Defence Minister Chris Benk, also talking about defence spending, mentioned that it could be helpful for New Zealand to revisit the nuclear conversation. What's the ACT Party's view on the nuclear-free stance that New Zealand has maintained?
Look, I actually haven't talked to my colleagues about this, so I don't want to give an ACT Party perspective, but I can give you my perspective. Look, the Prime Minister has said that New Zealand is not going to change a nuclear-free policy, but I have to actually agree with Chris Benk in a way. I think when you even say the word nuclear to New Zealanders, it means so many different things, and it could mean, you know, nuclear power, it could mean nuclear waste, nuclear fallout. It could mean nuclear weapons, all of these things. I think having some kind of conversation around nuclear-powered, whether it's nuclear-powered submarines or, say, vessels coming into New Zealand in the future, is something to have in advance, because Australia have ordered these. Like I said, they're our formal ally. Are we going to, at some point in the future, not allow them to dock in New Zealand waters? If there was some sort of, potential conflict. Like, I think it's worth having those conversations earlier, and I'm not taking a stance either way. I just think it's worth having while you're in a position to discuss things rather than being forced into making a decision under, not so favourable circumstances. So I have to kind of somewhat agree with Chris Benk that, look, the ACT Party itself doesn't have a position. We're quite proud of New Zealand's nuclear-free stance, but I think there is no harm in having an adult conversation around it.
Lastly, I want to talk about fees-free. It's been a pretty big announcement over the course of this budget, and also the announcement that university fees are going to go up as well. It's hard for students not to see this as a slap in the face, especially as many are struggling with getting jobs, especially as many are struggling with high cost of living already and getting saddled with a larger amount of debt that many of them didn't expect to see, right? Some people would have started their degree with the proposition of last year fees-free and now no longer have that available. What's the ACT Party's response to these students who are saying, we've been a little bit screwed over by this announcement?
Yeah, look, I acknowledge that it's really tough out there for uni students, as it is for families with young kids, for example. Like, everybody is finding it really hard. But fees-free was really expensive and poorly targeted. It's failed to solve the problem that it was really meant to address. And much of the funding went to people who, you've already made it. If you've got in the door at university, you've done actually pretty well in life. There's been really underinvestment in things like the vocational studies, like trades, for example. And now I go to small businesses quite frequently and they're screaming out for like electrical engineers and mechanical engineers, for example, and the trade side of things, not necessarily the degree side. So we've got that shortage in our workforce, which means that we need to have, bring people into the country to fill those spots. So ideally, we would want young people to have opportunities in those areas. But I accept that it would be, it's an extra debt that you take on. It's pretty hard. But I'd also say, the educational funding pyramid in New Zealand is inverted. If you look at how much funding, say, ECE gets, and parents having to pay sort of $300-$500 a week to send a child off to ECE so that they can continue working, right up to the funding into primary school and then even into high school. If you look at tertiary, it's still really subsidised here in New Zealand, and we need to think about where are we getting the best value for money. And while I accept it'd be really hard as a student if you've got to that point and you're like, oh my goodness, I'm now getting this extra debt, I also would turn around and say, like, think about those poorer families and those kids that are just starting out in the education, and the chances of them getting to where you've got to start university are much, much lower. So we really need to be investing in them and where we could get them into the workforce at some point.
There's a huge amount of money that the government is getting from scrapping Fees Free. As you've mentioned, there are high costs of ECE right now and other education for families with kids. Could the government just take this money and subsidise those costs right now? Is that something that the government's interested in doing?
Well, look, I think I don't know exactly where they're reallocating it to, but there has been a big uplift in definitely in primary school, like having teacher aides, for example. So we've seen some increased funding for that, which classrooms have been screaming out for quite some time. We've seen an increase in like the infrastructure side of things, like for new builds of classrooms. I know here in Christchurch, some of the schools around Horswell are getting some extra rooms, which they're desperate for because the classrooms are getting up over 30 kids per class. So I think it has been reinvested well into the education side of it. Even ECE has seen a small uplift as well. But overall, I do think that the way we fund education does need to change, and it needs to be a more streamlined, fair way of doing it, depending on, you know, what people can and cannot afford as well.
I think another thing that's important about the fees-free change as well is that the government already changed fees-free. Earlier in its term, the government said, we can't have first-year fees-free, let's move it to the last year of study to incentivise students to stay until that final year. Why spend all of the time, all of the effort, all of the money in changing this policy and shifting things around just to scrap it again a couple years later?
Yep, look, I reckon that inconsistency is really not fair, and like you alluded to it at the start, that there will be some people that have started and they've like, oh, okay, first year's gone, but I'm going to get my third year. I think that if we were going to make this call, we should have just done it from the outset. And that would have been at stance all along, but I can't talk for our coalition partners and what it was that they were thinking with this. But I do think that it was always poorly targeted. The statistics show that it didn't encourage more people into university study. Those that got there in the first place were going to attend regardless. And we knew that the vocational side of things, we were seeing shortages in the workforce. So I really think that this has been, in my opinion, and an ex-opinion, that we should have actually just done this a lot earlier and reprioritised that money.
That was the ACT Party's Laura McClure speaking to me about the budget and her visit to Taiwan.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Baby Heavyweight by Delaney Davidson.
Bye. looking at you. Yeah, I'm looking at you. Yeah, I'm looking at you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Favourite Little Star by Garageland.
Well, you know, my favourite BFM ad is Fuck Knuckles, Cock and Piss.
The Wire.
New research has been released which found people who spend more of their lives in socioeconomically disadvantaged areas have a significantly higher risk of premature deaths of despair. These kinds of deaths include suicide, drug overdose, and alcohol-related diseases. The findings of the report suggest neighborhood effects frequently operate independently of individual-level factors, indicating expanding public health beyond individual treatment to wider neighborhood care may be necessary to help those most in need. To discuss deprived areas linked to deaths of despair and how best to solve the issue, I talked to University of Auckland Social Sciences Professor Barry Milne. I started by asking Professor Milne to explain the methodology of the study.
What we did is we investigated whether neighbourhood deprivation was associated with deaths of despair. So deaths of despair are deaths from suicide, drug deaths and alcohol deaths. And we also investigated with whether neighbourhood deprivation was associated with a syndrome of despair at midlife. And that syndrome of despair are things that lead to deaths of despair. So suicidality, so thoughts of suicide, substance misuse, sleep problems and chronic pain. And we did this using two data sets. So we use the whole New Zealand population. So that's using a data source called the Integrated Data Infrastructure. We looked at 2.4 million people born between 1955 and 1994 and investigated their deaths of despair from 2015 to 2019. And amongst that group, there was 3,000 deaths of despair in that five-year time frame, which is about 1 in 8 deaths for that age group. About 60% of those were suicide deaths, 20% of those were alcohol deaths, and 20% of those drug deaths. And what we found is that those who lived in more deprived neighbourhoods were more likely to experience a death of despair. So the more deprived your neighbourhood was, the more likely you were to have a death of despair. It wasn't explained by people's income, people's education, people's ethnicity, and a few other bits and pieces. We couldn't really control for what we might call selection effects. So is it something about the neighbourhood that raises people's risk of death or despair, or is it because people who have other characteristics that make them more likely to experience a death or despair are more likely to live in those neighbourhoods? So we then turned to a second data set, which was the Dunedin study, which you may have heard of. So that's a group of around 1,000 individuals who were born in Dunedin in 1972-73, and then we followed up ever since. And what we found there is that more people who lived in the more deprived neighbourhoods had a greater, more likely to have a syndrome of despair. So those are the things I was talking about before, that is sort of thoughts of suicide, substance misuse problems, sleep problems, and chronic pain. And moreover, what we're able to do there is rule out these selection effects. So it wasn't just the people grew up in poor childhood or had physical and health, mental health problems themselves, who had low education or had more likely to have a family history of mental health. When we control for those things, you still see this association between the neighbourhood you live in and your syndrome of despair in that case. And moreover, whereas the age-related effect where people travel up through the socioeconomic gradient as they age, so you're more likely to live in better environments as you get older, but some people don't, those people who didn't were the ones who were at greatest risk of this syndrome of despair.
You mentioned the death of despair there, and you gave us a bit of an explanation. It's clearly quite important, and you found this link. Why was it you decided to focus on these kinds of deaths?
Okay, so the death of despair is a term that was coined, it's probably coined about 10 or 15 years ago, but it was coined to explain what was going on in the United States from the 1990s, where there was this increase in deaths in midlife. So the one thing that I should emphasize here we're looking at people aged 25 to 64, so sort of working age individuals. And this was shown to there's be an increase in that in the United States from the 1990s onwards, coincided with the opioid epidemic. But it wasn't just opioids, it was also, that was a major part of the United States, but also suicides and alcohol deaths as well. And this was shown in the United States, and we, a few years ago, started to wonder, as others had, is this something that's specific to the United States? And we investigated in a previous study comparing New Zealand and Denmark and showed that there were deaths of despair in New Zealand that were associated with poorer living conditions. They, unlike the United States, they don't seem to have gone up, though. So it was a relatively stable number of deaths in New Zealand through deaths of despair, which, again, is the sort of suicide deaths, the drug deaths, the alcohol deaths.
So now we have this socioeconomic neighbourhood link to these deaths of despair. Does this suggest a more proactive and systematic approach to policy solutions for these kinds of deaths is important to implement rather than maybe a more reactive individual treatment?
I think that's certainly the case. I don't think you want to be reactive. One of the mechanisms that's been suggested for this, which there's a little bit of evidence but not much, is this kind of a fatalism amongst people who end up having a death of despair. So they're more likely to believe that there's little they can do to improve their situation. There's a real or perceived lack of opportunity, or in the neighbourhood sense, there's a community level sense of alienation from, you know, people who live in more advantaged situations. So if fatalism is that mechanism, then generally, forgetting about neighbourhood effects, improving socioeconomic prospects may help reduce that fatalism and its consequences. So that's a society-level thing. That's an individual-level thing. I think another implication is that when you're considering what you can do to reduce these deaths, aspects of the neighbourhood should be considered. There's some, small studies that have shown, causal studies that have shown that if you improve a neighbourhood, it can actually improve people's mental health. So they ran this study in Philadelphia where they had various empty lots around Philadelphia, and they randomly selected empty lots to either have nothing done to them or be cleaned up a little bit and tidied. And a third set of empty lots were randomized to be planted with trees and sort of had good upkeep. And what they found actually is the people who lived near the empty lots that were turned into sort of green areas had the biggest improvement in their mental health. So I think there are things that can be done.
With a current cost of living crisis going on and support for these deprived communities becoming somewhat rarer, do you worry that this issue could get worse?
I guess I am. I mean, things can change very quickly in New Zealand depending on what sort of policies are implemented. But it's certainly something to keep an eye on. As I say, if the mechanism is living in poor areas and leading on to fatalism or whatever the other mechanism is, then yes, if that goes on for long enough, then that could lead to a greater number of these deaths.
That was University of Auckland Social Sciences Professor Barry Milne speaking to me about the deprived areas linked to deaths of despair.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire. Defence Minister Chris Pink recently tabled New Zealand's nuclear-free stance for debate when he suggested it could be a topic New Zealand should look into. In an interview with Newstalk ZB's Heather Duplessis-Allen, however, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon denied that the country's stance would change anytime soon. While Duplessis-Allen asked primarily about the military applications of nuclear technology, she also mentioned the potential benefits of nuclear energy. It's an important question, especially as New Zealanders see rising energy prices and seek to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. To discuss what the potential benefits of nuclear energy could look like, and whether they're any better than our current energy infrastructure in New Zealand, I spoke to Associate Professor at the University of Auckland and Co-Director at the Geothermal Institute, Sadio Zarouk. What is nuclear energy and how does it work, I guess? Is it something that we're familiar with of old, with all of these images of reactors and radiation and stuff, or is it different to that?
Yes, basically you react nuclear fuel, which is uranium-235 in the reactor, and that generates heat, and the heat is used to heat the steam, and the steam turns the turbine like any thermal power station and make electricity. That's how it works. There are two types of reactors, by the way. There are research reactors where you do reaction for research, then you can produce, there are some agricultural, there are nuclear medicine that can generate it here, but there is the power generation side of reactors where you generate, it's for pure generation of electricity. And there are many power stations around the world, I'm sure you know.
And how does the output of a nuclear reactor compare to what we've got right now in New Zealand?
It's just like a thermal power station. Compare it, for example, with Huntly. Normally they are big unit, 400 megawatts, even 1,000 megawatts. So you can generate a lot of electricity, you know, in one site.
And people have been tabling the nuclear debate recently talking about New Zealand's nuclear-free stance and whether we should continue along that road. And people have also brought up the idea that nuclear energy could be brought in to solve some of New Zealand's energy woes. How do you think nuclear energy compares to the pathways that we're currently going down?
Well, basically, I believe New Zealand should stay on the current path. The country made the decisions many years ago, and it was the right decision, and we should stay with that. To go into that industry, you need a massive... Well, you need to start with regulation. The regulation need to adapt to what a nuclear facility will look like, which we don't have that these regulations. And then you need to have the industry to support a power station, a massive industry, high tech. You need to train the people. The people who run operate nuclear power stations have special skills, very costly training, because you're going to trust them with running a power station that if something go wrong, it will result in a disaster. I'm sure you heard of Chernobyl, Fukushima recently. There are many other small incidents around the world. The countries that run on nuclear or have the nuclear industry, they have a massive industry to support these operations. So, and that we have none of that. For example, what do you do with the nuclear waste? Where do you store that nuclear waste? Do people like to store it under their area? The New Zealand also, how do you process nuclear fuel after you used it? Where do we get that fuel from? You know, we have to purchase it, and there's, you know, you can't produce nuclear fuel. We don't want to get into enrichment and so on. It's another industry to do that. So you'll be buying that fuel, using it, and shipping it back to the for processing. And your nuclear waste need to go somewhere, otherwise you need to store it here and no one wants it in their backyard.
And if we compare that to what we've currently got in renewables, obviously you're an expert in the geothermal side of things. Do our renewables currently provide enough energy for New Zealand, and how will our renewable energy infrastructure develop alongside population growth and industry growth moving forward?
Well, the industry is growing. There's significant growth in geothermal. An expansion project just happened last month at Ngāti Mariki, and there's few projects in the pipeline, and also the other renewables. There are generation coming from solar and wind. You know, maybe the rate of growth is not what we want, but it can eventually fill up the gap of fossil fuel. We don't need much replacement of fossil fuel, by the way, because New Zealand is almost 90% on renewable already. So bringing nuclear to the mix, there's not much room for a large nuclear power station. So New Zealand is taking the right path. Just persevere with geothermal, wind and solar. And it can happen eventually.
And some people have criticised, the current energy situation in New Zealand, because as you've mentioned, while a lot of it is on renewables, people are facing some high prices at certain times of year, or there are some concerns over maybe the resilience of our energy infrastructure in terms of climate disaster or that sort of thing. Do you think our energy sector could see improvements to address some of these problems going forward, and what do you think these improvements could look like?
It's a bit complicated question to answer, but I can assure you nuclear will not be the solution. If you want to cut cost with all the things I outlined, nuclear will not solve the problem. That it will not reduce the price of electricity, because all the things that you need to have in place to get there with the generation. Yeah, there is, as I said, renewable is growing, and further support and investment from the private sector, and it's happening already. And I don't think the New Zealand grid is reasonably resilient if you compare us to other countries. I know there was a program at Union College in the U.S. They come and study the New Zealand great system. Well, they bring their students and they study the entire system from up north, down south, as a model. So I think it's reasonably resilient. I don't know the details, that's not my area, but compare us to many countries, we don't have those blackouts and so on. And it demand, and currently thermal plants can take the spike in demand in during maybe cold weather nights or days. And with push further with renewable, I think it can be done.
And particularly on geothermal, is there anything you'd like to see going forward in the geothermal sector? Is there anything you're hoping for as we develop it further in Aotearoa?
I think there's a lot of projects going underway, and the government is supporting, to be honest. The previous government and the current government all been supportive. They put money into geothermal research, and they put money, you know, they facilitate projects and consent. So I think we are on the right path, and New Zealand geothermal industry is an example. Even our regulations are examples to many countries around the world. Come and see how we regulate geothermal, how we manage them, how we reduce their impact on the environment. So we are on the right track, just a further perseverance. We can be 100% renewable sometime down the track. So it's achievable. Prices, I don't know, but the geothermal that we do in New Zealand is basically the simplest and easiest, where the fruit is low-hanging compared to other geothermal people do. Also, New Zealand have a very ambitious project of drilling into supercritical deep heat project that's going on next year to explore the next generation of geothermal. If that project is successful, then we'll tap into a new energy source that we haven't tapped before, and that can generate way more electricity and make our energy supply more resilient.
That was co-director at the Geothermal Institute, Sadio Zaruk, speaking to me about the use case for nuclear energy in Aotearoa. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Tawhito by Mokotron.
I don't mean to. Rock and roll, man.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Decline by Proza.
Around, you know, up to
8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Last week, the Danish government officially confirmed it will be lowering the legal limits for nitrate contamination in water, according to recommendations from an independent scientific review commissioned by the Danish Ministry for the Environment. The change came after outcry from Danish citizens over the country's pork industry and its links to water contamination. Greenpeace Aotearoa is now saying that New Zealand should follow Denmark's lead and lower their legal nitrate levels to the same point. There has recently been suggestions that New Zealand is in a nitrate crisis, with the Canterbury Regional Council declaring an emergency last year and Southland facing increasing calls to do the same. To discuss the lowering of drinking water nitrate limits, I talked to Greenpeace freshwater campaigner Will Appleby. Can you start off just by explaining the Danish decision to lower water nitrate limits? What has led them to see the issue as important enough to address it and the context of the issue?
Sure. So there's a growing body of scientific evidence that has associated several risks to human health with nitrate contamination in drinking water. Currently, the legal limit for nitrate contamination is 11.3 milligrams per litre. Now, that level was set in the 1950s to avoid a condition called Blue Baby Syndrome, which is a terrible condition where the nitrate in drinking water, when it's mixed with baby formula and fed to babies, it can starve the baby's blood of oxygen. Now, that limit of 11.3 milligrams per litre, that was set in the 1950s, and it hasn't been updated since. What we're seeing now is that above 1 milligram per litre, there's an increased risk of bowel cancer over the long-term exposure to nitrate in drinking water. And that risk increases along with the increased level of nitrate. So when you get to 8 milligrams per litre of nitrate in drinking water, the long-term risk of bowel cancer is closer to 32%. So what the Danish government has done, they've just had an election. Prior to the election, the Minister of Environment established an expert panel to make a recommendation of what their nitrate level should be. And that panel came back saying we should be taking a precautionary approach because of the risk to human health, the long-term risk to human health, and it should be lower to 1.3 milligrams per litre. And following the election, the government's been formed in Denmark, and in part of their coalition agreement, staff committed themselves to lowering the nitrate level.
Now, this is an issue that impacts New Zealand quite directly. Last year, the Canterbury Regional Council declared a nitrate emergency. There's been calls for Southland to do the same. If this is such a big issue here, why has Denmark beat us to this response, and why have we not been quick to respond in the same manner?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent question. The dairy industry is a very powerful force in New Zealand politics, and that's one issue that we have to contend with. In Denmark, one of the first studies that established that there was an associative risk between bowel cancer and long-term exposure to nitrate in drinking water. That study was from Denmark, but the issues apply here as well. New Zealand has been slow to respond to this issue, and what we know is it's not just bowel cancer, right? There's also a risk of preterm birth above 5 milligrams per litre. And the New Zealand College of Midwives recommends that preterm people should consider another source of drinking water if theirs is above 5 milligrams per litre. But yeah, the dairy industry in New Zealand, it has a lot of political privilege in New Zealand, and I think that's one of the reasons why New Zealand has been slow to react.
Yeah, you mentioned there the dairy industry's power, and also often, the actual people in rural communities who are being impacted by this can be underrepresented in Parliament. Do you think this is going to make it difficult to get the government to listen to your pleas?
Well, I mean, the fact that Denmark has made this move, it's quite a major development for another country to move and lower the nitrate limit. And, New Zealand will have to take notice. The growing body of evidence does show that there is several risks to human health, and the weight of that evidence supports taking a precautionary approach to ensure that we don't cause undue harm to people that are drinking this water. Across the country, look, 80% of New Zealanders, their water is below 1 milligram per litre, and that's what we'd consider safe. But that still leaves about 15% of the country that's where their water could be putting them at risk of harm. And these are mostly rural communities that cannot safely drink the water coming out of their kitchen tap. Towns like Darfield and Oxford in Canterbury, Lumsden in Southland, Gore has had issues with high levels of nitrate in their drinking water, so much so that they were issued a do not drink notice last year. you know, these are people's lives that are being impacted by this contamination of their drinking water, and we can't continue going on and ignoring that. At the moment, Fonterra and other corporations are reaping record profits. And while their intensive dairy farms are leaking nitrates into the soil and into water systems, we cannot let that to continue. And eventually the government is going to have to take notice.
How difficult would it be for these corporations to make adjustments to ensure the nitrate levels decrease in drinking water?
Well, look, we need to see the legal limit for nitrate needs to be lowered, but that's not going to address the source of the nitrate, which is fundamentally the intensive dairy industry. We need to transition to other forms of land use, other forms of ecological sustainably farming practices that don't pollute the climate with methane emissions and don't contaminate people's drinking water with nitrate. So fundamentally, that's what we need to see in the long term, is a transition away from these big dirty industries that aren't benefiting people in their local communities. They're benefiting corporates like Fonterra, whilst the locals in those rural areas are having to pick up the tab for either installing their own filtration systems to filter the nitrate, which costs a lot of money, or having to deal with the health impacts as a result, the potential health impacts as a result of that nitrate contamination.
And do you expect there to be an international response to this decision by Denmark? Will we see other countries following suit?
Other countries have considered this issue in the past and have been actively considering whether or not they lower the nitrate limits in different countries. The EPA in the United States has considered it in the past, and we're doing some work on it. The Trump administration has, you know, blocked that in its path and during its first term, and I believe in this current term as well. So yeah, it's politically tricky waters to navigate when it comes to the nitrate contamination of people's drinking water, because largely in most cases the source of the nitrate is agriculture, which is a powerful lobby not just in New Zealand but across the globe. But yeah, we're talking, everyone should be able to drink the water from their kitchen tap without worrying about getting sick. And the reality is right now that for many people in rural areas in New Zealand, that's no longer the case.
That was Greenpeace freshwater campaigner Will Appleby speaking to me about lowering drinking water nitrate limits.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoi, kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Laura McClure, co-director at the Geothermal Institute, Sadio Zaruk, Greenpeace Freshwater Coordinator Will Appleby, and University of Auckland Social Sciences Professor Barry Milne. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.